But yeah, I mean, Rainy Day Women 12 and 35. I mean, you know, you just got to come up with a title.
Exactly. There you go. Well, speaking of titles, time for us to talk books, Sports Lit 101 this week. And what have we got?
Well, we talked a couple of weeks ago about an article from this book, Overcoming the Neutral Zone Trap, Hockey Agents of Change, edited by Cheryl McDonald, Jonathan R.J. Edwards. And we talked about Angie Abdu's article, friend of the show, about how she and Carl Subban have become great friends on the various book tours and at conferences, and that they had sort of, and Angie was sure Carl wasn't going to like her, and they would, but it turned out they'd become quite good friends. And they're going to join us at a future time. The Canadian Post Office has not gotten me Carl's book, or the U.S. Post Office hasn't yet, but it's coming. Then what we're going to talk about this week is also another person I know who will certainly become a friend of the show, Fred Mason. And Fred is a very, very fascinating guy. He's an ultra marathoner. He teaches at the University of New Brunswick, both in sport and literature and kinesiology. But he really examines, Fred always examines things from angles none of the rest of us are really thinking about. And every once in a while, I'll see Fred's going to make a presentation at SLA, at the Sport Literature Association. I'll go, what the hell is this? You know, and then it'll be riveting. He's a very enthusiastic and very, very smart guy. So what drew me to look at this article was that he talks about in the article about two books. The title of the article is The Tragedy of the Enforcer. And he talks about a book by Lynn Cody called The Antagonist, which early on when we were first doing Sports Lit was one of the books that I talked about, which is about it's an epistolary novel. But instead of actual letters being written back and forth, it's based on emails. And the emails are between a guy who's written a book and the guy who the book is ostensibly about, even though it's not saying that it's about him. And that is Rank Gordon. Gord Rankin. And Gord Rankin was an enforcer in university hockey, which is the one flaw in the book, because there are no enforcers in university hockey in Canada or in the NCAA, because if you fight, you get thrown out, and you fight a second time, you might be banned. But anyway, he was encouraged to do this by his dad. His father owned a restaurant, and late at night he often had trouble, so he would have Gord go out, and who was known as Rank, and sort of take care of things. And what Fred does is examine that book and also a graphic novel, which I've not read, by Jeff Lemire or Jeff Lemire. I apologize for not knowing exactly how to say it, called Roughneck. And he examines it beginning by looking back at the 2011 season. That is a year where CTE came into hockey in a big way. That's when Bob Probert died of a heart attack. They found out he had CTE. Derek Bugard died of a drug overdose. Rick Rippon and Wake Belak both died after suicides with depression. And Chris Nyland talked about how the terrible problems he's had with alcohol and other substances. George Larocque, who's the unlikeliest tough guy, was the cut in English. But it was about how at that time also we began to see the disappearance of the enforcer. Mm. You know, there are a few goons out there. Tom Wilson in my book is one of them. But the salary cap and the need to have four productive lines, and now especially with COVID, you're not going to put a guy on your taxi right. squad or your team that can't play. So that while there are still big tough guys that are expected to be very physical players, the day of the enforcer probably is going to end. The problem is, will the myth of the enforcer sort of die with it? You know, the noble hockey fight. Well, you know, but somewhere between Don Cherry and the truth is you know, is where that lies.
That, by the way, would be a great book title.
Yeah. When I was in prep school and I would come home on vacations, I got to go down to a rink in Connecticut and scrimmage and play pickup games with the guys who were on a semi-pro team called the Norwalk Oilers that were sponsored by an oil company. And they were older and bigger than me. And every once in a while, I had to, you know, prove that they weren't going to drive me out of the rink. I got really good at doing the things that you could do to drop somebody without dropping the gloves, because if I went back to prep school and did that, I'd be in a whole lot of trouble. And I can remember thinking at that time as a young, impressionable kid that, you know, the enforcer was an important person. But really, unless someone ran your goalie or took a cheap shot that hurt one of your players, you know, if somebody leveled a big hit and it was just a big hit, then you can retaliate the same way. What Fred really investigates is how this goes all the way through hockey culture. In the other book, Roughneck, the protagonist, if you will, Derek, is indigenous, and that plays a very key role in how his life in this, and these are novels, I want to remind people, and all the associated problems that have affected indigenous hockey players, because that is going to be the next week's thing we're going to talk about, an article about how a disproportionate number of enforcers over the years have been indigenous people. The question is, was that by the choice of the players, or was it indeed more the way they were directed? And in both of these books, the enforcer was directed to become that by dad.
Interesting.
You know, and it is interesting, because I think about my favorite book, a hockey novel to do with an enforcer is, there are two of them, The Good Body, which we've talked about a number of times, but that's more complicated. And The Last Season by Roy McFarlane, which is one of the first, if not the prime example of a hockey novel. I mean, many people think that's the modern hockey novel right there, The Last Season. We look at violence in funny ways, because in football or baseball, if people are throwing punches, then people are getting thrown out of the game. You throw a punch in the NFL and you can get ejected. You throw a punch in a hockey game, depending on the situation, and all you get is a five-minute sit-down. And it's becoming clearer and clearer that concussions, when you take off somebody's helmet and whack them in the head, are going to be a much more common thing than we saw before. When you look at the way these players feel that in these novels, again, in these novels, not the Bugards, not the Nylands, that's a whole different story. When they get thrust into the role of being the enforcer, it's because that's the way they can be part of the team. Mm. That's the way they get to play. And I was thinking about how we've talked so much about how video games have taken a lot of kids out of sports because they get to be the quarterback or they get to be the wide receiver. They play in these fantasy games. You know, being an enforcer is almost a fantasy too. I mean, I do remember my coach in prep school saying to me once, if we get up by one more goal, just remember what he did to Reed, who was our goalie. And it wasn't to go out and start a fight, because that wouldn't have been. And my coach was a good guy. He was a Bowdoin grad, very smart guy. And the guy made the mistake of skating down. He had his head down, and a hip checked him and went over the boards. And I can remember feeling, wow, I had done something so important. In the long run, there were 2 minutes to go. We were up 3-1. You know, we weren't winning many games that year, and I hadn't really done anything except get even. You know, it took me years later to understand. I still remember, you know, at the time I was like, yes, I'm looking at the guy like, don't climb back over, buddy. You don't want another piece of me, right? And then thinking later that how almost clownish that was. But since I wasn't putting the puck in the net like Billy and Duke and all the other guys in the team who were much better hockey players than I was, I when I see these books, I see where people go. And Fred's done a really interesting job looking at both research and scholarly stuff, and then just getting into the meat of the fiction. And hopefully this spring, as long as the border is open, I want to have him come down to my class and talk, and then we'll try and set that up so that he stays over, and on a Wednesday he can come visit. We can talk about this more.
Excellent. All right. The book is called Overcoming the Neutral Zone Trap, Hockey's Agents of Change. And what have we got ahead in the next couple of weeks of Sports
Lit? Well, next week we're going to look at the role, give me the exact title of this article, because I don't want to mispronounce it or missay what I'm supposed to say. But we're going to talk about we have two more articles. One is My Journey from Upright Hockey to Sledge Hockey and Back Again, and how... Who's disabled and who isn't, and how much disabled are you, and are you crashing that? But next week we're going to talk about Skating Towards Reconciliation by Vicky Parashak, a survivance history of Indigenous people in hockey in Canada, which, you know, especially having met Brady Keeper late of the University of Maine and with the Vancouver Canucks organization now, and talked to Alfie Michu some about it. I really was interested in this article because every single Indigenous hockey player that's made it to the NHL, rather, when someone has asked them, "Were you ever called Chief?" Yeah, always called Chief, or you know, always got some, you know, "Don't tomahawk him, Chief." And, yeah. You know, that they say it's against Indigenous people, it's as bad in Canada as here. They say for people of color that are more recognizable as being African American or African Canadian, they don't get as much, they don't hear as much in Canada as they do the farther south they get in the U.S. So it's interesting. Be fun to talk about.
Absolutely. Speaking of that, did you see what the Bruins did last night?
With Willie O'Ree?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm so sad he couldn't be there, but he's such an articulate man, Willie O'Ree. I could listen to him talk all day.
Retired his number last night on the anniversary of him playing in the National Hockey League, becoming the first Canadian, African-Canadian yep. player in the NHL. He's 86 years old.
Yeah, and he lost his eye and continued to play for 16 years.
Right.
You know what else is interesting about that? We can justifiably complain and be angry that the Red Sox were the last team to integrate. But let us not forget that the Boston Bruins were the first team to integrate.
Yeah, our friend Colin Fleming tweeted about that last night. And not only that, but the Celtics were on that train pretty early, too, with Chuck Cooper.
Chuck Cooper, yeah. Was he out of West Virginia, I think?
I forget.
I read a book about that, but yeah, so you know, let's give the adults in the sports world in Boston some credit. And the thing is, O'Ree,
they weren't all Tom Yawkey.
No, they were not all Tom Yawkey. And Willie O'Ree, think about his chances. 1% of the population of New Brunswick was African American when he was playing hockey. 1%, and he makes it to the NHL.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and he said that he never, until he got out of New Brunswick, it was ever heard race. Ever heard it.
An amazing story. But kudos to the Bruins for doing that last night. It's 4:47 here on Downtown. We'll take a break, come back, or wrap up the hour later in the program. We talk more hockey with head coach of the Maine Black Bears, Ben Barr. This is Downtown on Z62.
When the dog bites, when the bee stings, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember my favorite things, and then I don't feel so bad.
Hello everyone, this is Julie Andrews and you're listening to Downtown with